and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. This is Brock Dennis, and this is where we are simplifying the good life and drinking lots of rum.
It's true. I'm Brandon Rhodes, and we are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
You know, I have a sticker on my helmet now that says People's Republic of Portland.
Good.
I wanted one for the longest time, and now I actually have it.
Good. Got to get one that says nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
Yeah. You know, actually, it's hard to say, not having done it yet, but by the time this episode airs, I may indeed have the Sprocket Podcast stickers.
Oh, that's exciting.
For everyone to put on their bikes and helmets and cars if you want to, I guess, or whatever. We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations, somewhat distracted conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life
has
to offer.
Thinking locally.
Along the way.
Closing my eyes. That's local enough for me. We are covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communications, and the internet, and sundry other vagaries.
That's right. Lols at cats. Or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, here we are.
It was not enough of a stretch there,
Mark. That's okay. No, I really didn't have anything in mind when I said that. This is the last of the pre-recorded interview segments.
Yes, things. And it completes our first full calendar year.
Yeah, definitely. Like, we started slightly before the calendar year of 2011. So 2011 was the year of the Sprocket, and 2012 will, I suppose, be as well. So, yeah, here we are. You know, something that we didn't say on the last four episodes was we have an email address, and you can write to us. It's thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. So you got something you want to say? Say it.
And we'll say it on the air, almost certainly.
That's right.
And if you have an accent you'd like either of us, please specify which of us you'd like to say it in what accent.
Exactly.
We're doing an impression.
Yeah, we'll do anything you want.
We will do anything you want.
We are yours. We can be bought. And for not as high a price as you would imagine.
Nigh, but a simple email in our Gmail.
New Year's, man. No doubt at this point, by the time this episode comes out, you and I will have both been celebrating. Do you have New Year's plans?
I think Candace's old house, the Canby house, they're doing a mock prom.
Oh, right. Thing, it's like, yeah. What, all the themes of
all,
every
yeah, all
prom
the stars
ever?
Under the sand sea shore. I'll be wearing seafoam.
There we go. Nice. And not your lit-up jacket as
I'll probably just wind up wearing that.
Okay, sure. Well, you could wrap it in seafoam. That'd be fun.
Well, seafoam's a color.
Oh, okay, never mind. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
I'll be wearing mousse.
Yeah. wearing mousse, like the edible kind of mousse?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not the animal.
So have you ever seen, there used to be an album back in the day by Herb Alpert, the Tijuana Brass, called Whipped Cream and Other Delights.
Ooh.
And this was a very popular album, not necessarily because of the Tijuana Brass, but because it featured a lady that was otherwise nude, but covered in whipped cream and looking seductively at the camera. And I would imagine lots and lots of young men from back in the 70s were really excited about this whole thing. But that gave rise to lots and lots of parodies. The most famous...
That's Sundry Vagary number one, by the way.
That is, thank you. I think it was Sonic Youth, but I'm not sure. But they had an album called Clam Dip and Other Delights, in which I believe their lead singer was on the cover, and he was covered in Clam Dip. And it was not quite nearly as sexy. There was another one I saw that was...
This has been awkward music trivia with Brock Dittus.
There was another one with some unknown now, some virtual unknown, that, if I'm not mistaken, he was covered in spaghetti sauce. So... Anyways,
that was the first meme.
It really was.
Yeah, who needs rage comics?
You exactly. So anyways, that has nothing really to do with anything.
No.
But entertainment and amusement. New Year's Eve, for the past 2 years, I have spent in Boston and hanging out with my brother-in-law and his peeps over there. This year, I will actually be taking the train back from Boston across the United States. And that'll be a three-day trip from Boston to Portland. And we're supposed to get in, if the train runs on schedule, I think the morning of New Year's Eve.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it'll be out of the frying pan, into the fire.
Yeah,
just
hope you guys can take a nap and then come to the party, because that'd be fun.
That'll be at a quick nap and then waking up like at 10 p.m. to start the festivities. So
throw your hands in the air sometime.
Exactly, as though we don't even care.
Gotta let go.
I'm excited.
Cool.
So yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, when I was a kid, I used to have the habit, because like I grew up kind of without too many friends. I didn't really go to parties or anything in high school, and so when I was a kid, for New Year's Eve, when it turned midnight, I would stand in the driveway with a glass of ginger ale, looking at the stars and thinking about like what the next year could hold.
Holy shit!
And I always felt like I was really, really deep.
That's some heavy
and
And ginger ale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what,
you're like
it's what I could get my hands on at the time, so.
The high fathom and teetotaler right there, dude.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, or teenager, but.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think so much about deep things, I guess, on New Year's these days. So much. But.
More like, who brought the Chex Mix?
That's it, yeah. So we've got a pre-taped interview with Tom Labonte. He talks a little bit about his cargo back building business. Really exciting. And by the time you hear this, he'll probably be very close to being done with my tall bike, which he was building. I'm very excited about that. Two frames welded one atop the other with some extra structural steel to make it the biggest bike you've ever seen. So,
best ever.
Yeah, not the very biggest. I did see that YouTube clip with, was it four frames?
Yeah, okay.
One on top of the other. That was pretty exciting. Did you see that?
Yes, you hastily showed me.
That was awesome.
It was awesome.
Yeah. And the guy, basically, he climbed it like a ladder. He just, like, one rung after the other.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty impressive. So, anyways. But, Tom's a great guy, and you'll hear in this interview exactly how it is he does the things he does. Anything else you need to kick in before we're done?
No.
All right. Happy New Year. Happy 2012 to everybody. And we will look forward to seeing you next week when we return live with a full featured show.
Auld Lang Syne.
We'll take a cup of kindness now for Auld Lang Syne. All right. Happy New Year, all you Sprocket listeners, and we'll talk to you next time on the SprocketPodcast.com. So this is the Sprocket Podcast. I'm Brock Dittus, and I'm here with Tom Labonte of, is it Tom's Cargo Bikes? .com. So, tell me a little bit about how you roll and what you do.
Well, I build custom cargo bikes, but I build them out of used existing bicycle frames. And each bike is built for an individual who orders it. Generally, I like to build it out of the bike that they provide, so that the bike fits them and is of their liking. And I make it up as I go.
So each one is very customized then.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
There's no two alike.
Yeah.
I'm working on one right now that is, I'm actually trying to duplicate one for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be close, but I told the customer it'll be more fraternal than identical.
it was in the same womb, but
yes, exactly.
not of the same origin.
That's right.
Nice. So how did you get into building bikes in the first place? You mentioned right before we started recording that you're from Montana. So did you do some welding out there?
No, actually I did not. I grew up in Montana, and I would say my hobby at the time, my adult hobby was fixing up muscle cars. I concentrated on cars from the 60s and late 50s.
Okay.
And that's what I did in my spare time. Some friends and I, we rented out a garage and we'd go around and buy cars off farmers and fix them up. So I learned a lot of mechanical and how to make things work that are broken this way mechanically. And then I got a desire to pursue a different career, which was not available to me in Montana. So I came out here. And in the meantime, living in a larger city, the car became less and less important. Then my last Impala that I had, which I had a 65 Impala, which was my pride and joy.
Those are our classy cars.
Yeah. I was trying to convert it over to biodiesel a couple of years ago with the idea that then it would be a little less of a big tank,
Sure.
Burning up gasoline for no purpose.
Right. And then
But got in over my head, realized that the car just sat there.
Okay.
In the city, I don't need it. You know, I'm not cruising the country roads and stuff as much. And,
right.
Or going what have you. So anyway, so it sort of was waning off a few years ago, this interest in fixing up old cars. And then we had this massive snowstorm that shut the city down a few years ago.
Oh, is that the one in 2004?
2004, was it? I think it was
2008, I think.
I think 2008 okay, is the one I'm talking about, yeah. And
that was Snowpocalypse, I think.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one, which I love that.
Right.
Snowpocalypse is fabulous.
I would imagine, coming from Montana, you probably are well acquainted with snow.
Yeah.
And it probably wasn't a big deal to you, necessarily.
No, it was not a big deal to me,
but,
the snow itself, but the way we deal with it in the city is a big deal.
Right. And here in Portland, Oregon, nobody knows what to do with snow or where it comes from or, the dynamics, like everyone... People go nuts.
Well, yeah, and you know, the difference is in a lot of places that have a lot of snow have the equipment to deal with it, and Portland doesn't.
Right.
And so this is where the cargo bike business actually was germinated, I guess, was the main street in front of my house got a plow, came down it every once in a while,
uh-huh.
but none of the side streets.
Okay.
So we were pretty much locked in. Now, luckily, we live in a city that has TriMet, and you know, and I can get around.
Public transportation is great here.
Yeah, but there was no getting to the store or my daughter's school in the car.
Right.
For a few days. So we ran out of food, had to go to the grocery store. So we took the backpacks and walked. It's about 15 blocks. And it was fabulous.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that you're trudging through snow and it was cold.
Sure.
But it was fabulous to slow down and look at your neighborhood that you never see when you drive. And this really struck me.
Yeah.
And so I thought, when the snow goes away, I need to get some sort of bike that I can go to the grocery store and take my daughter to school. And so this is where it started.
There we go.
And
so you're also well equipped for, like, I guess, the car apocalypse. So when we hit peak oil and all the cars are abandoned on the side of the road, and all hope with them, we can just roll on with bicycles, I guess.
Yeah, hopefully. But, nice. Yeah. So then I work at the airport, and Alaska's maintenance crews use cargo bikes to move when they do oil changes on planes and
really?
And small. Small jobs.
Oh, wow. I don't fly much. I usually just once a year for the holidays or so, but I have never seen that. It's just outside on the, just where the planes load and everything.
Because yeah.
Usually you have those little electric vehicles, which are also pretty sweet, but Alaska Airlines uses cargo bikes?
Yeah, they use the Workman's front loading trike, the
really?
Tadpole trike. They have at least four, maybe even six of them lined up outside their maintenance area.
Yeah.
And you probably won't see them when you fly in and out because I mainly only see them at night.
Okay.
And they're doing work on planes that sit overnight.
I see.
So I thought, hey, I'm just going to build one of those bikes and go to the grocery store with that.
Sure.
And so that was my first attempt, was this tadpole style trike. I built four of them before I felt comfortable with what I had, and it worked great, other than it was slow.
Okay.
Really slow.
Slow, I would assume, just because there's a lot of metal, you're dealing with a lot of just the weight of the frame itself. Is it also like a gearing issue? Like,
I don't think it's gearing. I think it's the design with the two wheels up front.
Okay.
Because with a regular bike, okay, so first of all, I got to let you know I'm not a bike guy, so I don't know technical things about, like, recently, probably within the last 3 years, I learned what a bottom bracket is.
Okay,
I always called it a gearbox.
Sure.
So anyways.
I actually kind of like that term better.
Okay, well,
but, yeah.
This is where I'm coming from, with a very lack of technical understanding of bikes.
Right. So you're not posturing, you're not pretending to be anything you're not, then we'll clear that up now.
Yeah, for sure, and it will become apparent if you ask me anything technical.
Right. I actually kind of respect that, because it's, you know, it's easy, I think, if you're a bike mechanic to go out and say, hey, I'm going to make a bunch of cargo bikes, but you're saying, and I'm not really a bike mechanic, I'm just a guy that likes to put things together, and that's actually even more impressive to me, so...
Well, I appreciate that, but yeah, that is my, I guess that would be my definition. I just am a guy who puts things together.
Glad we put so fine a point on it.
Yeah. Well, it makes a lot of sense. But yeah, so then I experimented with these four different trikes. And of course, at work in the break room, I talk with my coworkers about what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my coworkers are bikers, and they participate in the STP, for instance, or the Reach the Beach. Some of them, this is a pretty serious deal. They've used their flight benefits to travel to different cities to participate in bike events.
It seems like that'd be the best reason to work at an airline, would just be the travel benefits and being able to go places for discounted or free or
I can't imagine what would have drawn me to the business if that didn't exist. So some of my coworkers being bike guys, I would talk to them about this, and one of them said that he had an old mountain bike in his shed and he wanted one of these Dutch Bokfiets bikes.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to build one out of his old mountain bike. So I said, well, I don't think I can. Those bikes, I've never seen one in real life, only in pictures, and they look technically beyond my ability.
Yeah, they do look pretty complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he said, well, this is a bike I don't use. Try it. What's the worst that can happen? So I built this bike, and the first time I rode it, I thought, this is the way to go.
Uh-huh.
Because it rides like a regular bike.
Right.
And this is where my lack of technical knowledge comes in. But for some reason, the trike, I went really slow.
Sure.
On the Bokfiet, I went much closer to what I would consider regular biking speed.
Right.
Not being a bike commuter or a racer or anything like that. To me, regular biking speed is pretty close to what the Bokfiet does.
Sure.
So, yeah. So then I, I parked the trike and started immediately. This was for him. My coworker Kevin, and so then I immediately started building one for myself, and I just shipped number 50 off to Sacramento last week.
Nice. So you're up to 50 bikes built by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Now I haven't sold all of them or delivered all of them. A few of them, after I built them and rode them around, realized that there was some fatal flaws and took them apart and used the parts for other bikes.
Okay.
And I still counted that as two separate bikes.
Yeah. Well, that's a build. I mean, it has its own unique qualities to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm at roughly 50. Some I haven't counted because either I forgot to count them when I built them or I don't classify them as a bike. Like I've built a couple bikes for a paint company here that you can't actually ride. They're strictly used to, you use the bike mechanism to drive a spinner.
Oh.
And then they make spin art.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's a purely artistic application then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not so much transportation, but yeah.
Right.
That's great.
They contacted a paint company here, a local environmental friendly paint company called YOLO.
Okay.
And they contacted
YOLO?
YOLO. It's
YOLO.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Correct. Uh huh. And they contacted me. They wanted a pedal powered paint spinner because they go to trade fairs and show off their paint and they do spin art to attract people's attention, and then people walk away with a keepsake from them, keep them in mind. The problem that they had was their electric one required a power source, so it limited where they could use it. And then sometimes they weren't close to a power source, and it required an amazing amount of extension cord.
Sure.
So they wanted a pedal powered one,
or a generator, I guess.
Right.
We had one of those out, but if you can do it on a bike, why not? Huh?
Yeah. So they asked me if I could do it, and I said, "Well, I can give it a try." And I decided to build it to look like, because I don't know if you've seen these, Starbucks does it every once in a while, these blender bikes.
I think I've seen, I've never seen one up close, but is this, it's like a blender mounted on the back rack?
No, it's actually, it looks like an exercise bike with a blender out in front of the handlebars.
Oh, okay.
And it runs off the front wheel.
Yeah.
And then there's no back wheel.
Okay.
I mean, it looks strictly like an exercise bike, and that's what they had in mind. And I thought, oh, that looks just like an exercise bike, and it has no...
It's not sexy at all.
Yeah, so I built it to look like a tadpole trike.
Okay.
And then we did it all beach cruiser with the white wall tires and the big fenders and
nice. The
big handlebars and stuff like that. And then you pedal it just like a regular bike, other than the chain goes forward and spins a differential and makes spin art.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that is sexy. That's got a flair of fashion to it.
Yeah, it's, it looks nice.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Nice. I think the last time I heard about something like that, I think my wife had gone to some sort of Earth Fair or something, and they were making smoothies with some sort of blender attachment. So,
well, there's some people here in town that are associated with Shift, which I'm not 100% sure how that all works, but they have an extra cycle attachment on a back end of a bike
mm-hmm.
that has a blender attachment.
That's pretty great.
And they we were both at the Multnomah Bike Fair this past summer.
Oh yeah.
And they asked me about the possibility of building a bike that's purposely built for that. So that's in the works right now. We haven't said go yet, but we're collaborating on that.
That's exciting. Yeah, that bike fair is such a great deal. I haven't been for many years. Ever since I got into long distance bicycle touring, the summer is the only time that I have long chunks of time free to go out and go places. So every time I've planned a trip, I've never known when the Pedalpalooza event is going to be. And so usually I end up booking myself out of town so I can't be there. But I love what they do, and I love the energy of the huge event, you know, all of it coming together. And was it Colonel Summers Park here in Portland again this year?
I don't remember exactly. It wasn't Colonel Summers Park, but there is on Belmont, there's an old school that has been closed down.
Yeah.
And it was on the grounds of that school.
Yeah. Is that Washington High School?
That might be.
Okay.
That
because it's a big building with a big field and right. It's not used. I always thought it'd be great if it was a McMenamins, if they bought that and turned it into something. But then I guess it wouldn't be free to just go and hang out. So actually, if you can have bike events there, that's even better.
Yeah. It's the second bike event I've been there. They had the Multnomah County Bike Fair this summer. And then I think it was last year, there was a lady here in town who was raising bikes, having people donate bikes, and then she shipped a container full of bikes to South Africa.
That sounds familiar. Yeah. I can't remember what it was called, but I think I remember hearing about something like that.
Well, the organization was Bikes for Humanity.
Okay,
And they shipped off this container to South Africa, but they had the container there at that school for people to drop off bikes.
Was it just a big big cargo box sort of thing?
Yeah, it was huge. And from my understanding was, they take the bikes over there, give the bikes out to people, and then they turn the shipping container into a bike shop.
Nice.
And then, so now you have a business, but you also have a clientele because of the bikes that exist in the community now.
Sure.
And I think that was the plan for that.
Right, because they're going to have to, I mean, you know as well as anybody else that bikes don't keep themselves up, and
right.
Eventually you have to work on them again, so yeah.
Yeah, so I donated two cargo bikes to that because I had one of my earlier ones that I had moved beyond because I had come up with new ideas and how to improve it. It was just sitting in my backyard. Excuse me. And I used it as a backup bike. And then I had another bike of a customer who backed out on me and I was almost finished. So the lady who ran it, which I don't remember her name right off the top of my head, she approached me about donating a bike right after this guy had backed out.
Oh,
so I thought, oh, well, I'll just finish this bike and give it to you.
It's almost ready. Might as well.
The materials have been paid for.
Yeah.
So I'm only out my time.
Right.
So I gave her that bike, and then I thought, oh, I have this other one sitting here that's just taking up space.
Yeah.
And she reported back to me after the container went to South Africa that one of the bikes she gave to a local high school shop teacher in South Africa, and his plan was to reverse engineer it and then teach students how to build it.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
That means your work is the basis of somebody else's learning and somebody else's eventual project.
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's fantastic that somebody might be building their own cargo bike in South Africa.
Yeah, that's really cool, actually. Yeah. That's fantastic. So I was thinking about just as far as putting bikes together. You said each one is different, of course, because you're using old frames and old bicycle pieces. So each one is going to be unique, but do you build them on kind of a rough model? Like, is there a certain look you're going for, or does each one have its own? Are you trying new things with each build?
Yeah, I actually try something new with each build just to try and improve it, make things. You know, I'm trying to come up with a system with the theory that if somebody orders from me, then it's just something I can build.
Okay,
and I don't have to make up as I go.
Yeah.
But what I'm discovering is that's just not possible with the endless variety of bike frames.
Sure.
Unless I buy the same bike frame every time, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then compound that with the fact that I have no jigs. So even if I did build the same bike frame, still going to be slightly different. So yeah, I try something new with each bike. Each bike lends itself to some different design too, based on the design of what the manufacturer built.
Yeah.
And then each customer is going to have their own vision, which is one of the things that I think is really beautiful about doing it this way, is that if the customer says, this is what I want the walls 6 inches, or I want the walls 4 inches, or I don't want any walls, then I have to figure that out, you know, and then it turns out nothing like the last one.
Right. That must be exciting. I suppose you don't get bored that way.
No, not at all. And each bike, I feel, you know, and I think this is with anybody who builds anything, each bike is a little bit better than the last one.
Sure. Yeah. So number 50 is definitely better than number one.
Yeah. I think actually number 50, I was actually a little reluctant to let it go.
Really? It's like your pride and joy, the crowning jewel of the whole collection.
Yeah. Well, it just turned out nice.
Yeah. That's cool. So,
Yeah.
Did you start with it? Do you think you started with nicer bikes as well, or was it just like the build itself?
No, it's just things I've learned from other bikes to make this one work better.
Yeah.
And look nicer. And I'm putting a lot more effort into the way they look now because I think I've figured out the mechanics of it. I feel comfortable with the mechanics of how the steering works and the kickstands and all this stuff, how to attach the two frames together. I feel very confident that I can do that. So now I can put a lot more effort into, you know, the aesthetics of it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So when you're building cargo bikes, I was just thinking about the steering system. It's kind of a, the ones that I've seen have like a, what, like an arm sort of system, so that you've got the handlebars in front of you and then the load in front of the handlebars and then the front wheel in front of the load or the cargo area. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, okay. That's what I'm doing. I haven't put that much research into it, but I guess this is stereotypically people call this a long john style.
Okay.
Or the Bock feet are the two big names in this.
Right. And it's okay. I know nothing about. I know maybe less than you about cargo bikes as far as terminology and how to discuss them. So,
well, I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
I don't know if you're familiar with Bike Snob NYC. He's got the blog and he talks about bake feats.
Okay. So
which
yeah,
I've always found amusing. But,
yeah, I was. You know, I've tried to pronounce it what makes sense to me, so yeah, I call it Bock feet.
That sounds right. Well, yeah, I mean, if anybody out there knows the proper pronunciation, if we have anybody out there maybe in Amsterdam or somewhere else in Holland, you could probably set us straight.
Right.
But so you've got the long john style anyways.
Yeah, yeah. And then so it's the steering is connected by a push rod is what I call it.
Okay.
So it's a long rod that has bearings on either end that allow it to swivel in a lot of degrees, not 360 degrees, but almost. And so then you can attach it to one focal point or fulcrum point. Again, I'm not an engineer.
That's fine.
And then you attach it to the next one. And then in theory, when you turn one, the other one turns equal.
There we go.
And I've recently, I think on number 47, number 46, somewhere around there recently, I experimented with a cable system using cables.
Really?
As opposed to the push rods.
Mm-hmm. How did that work out?
It worked out fantastic. On my website, I have a step-by-step instructions on how to build your own cargo bike.
There we go.
Based on my, rudimentary design.
and your experience.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I do is I took pictures along the way of building one of my bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I posted on there, and then I tried to type in little helpful hints about what you see.
Okay.
To build your bikes. And I've had tons of people from all over the world have contacted me telling me that they're going to try this. Based on my design, asking me questions like, how does this work? Because the picture is maybe not clear, have you. Anyways, a few people have contacted me showing me their own bikes that they've come up with their own ideas. And two different guys, one guy from California, one guy from Colorado, showed me this cable steering system that they had come up with that were almost identical. And these two guys working independent from each other.
Wow.
There's also a gentleman here in town who has a cargo bike that has a big speaker system on the front that's homemade.
Yeah.
And he has the same cable system that these two guys have. And so I think it's some sort of, if you have the engineering mind, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So using these three examples, I built my own. And the guy in Colorado was really helpful with actually telling me exactly what parts he used and stuff like that. And so I went to Home Depot and were able to find like screen door pulleys.
Oh, there you go.
I'm not going to the door section of Home Depot looking for bike parts, but this guy did. And then he sent me on my way. But anyways, it worked great. It's fantastic. I don't know, the longevity of it, but it sure does work great.
Yeah. Yeah, and so is that that's two cables, one to pull the wheel each direction? Or?
Yeah, well, with the push rod, because it's a stiff material, it will push and pull from one side.
There's not really any flex in there.
Right, but the cable won't, it will pull, but it won't push because it's not rigid. So you have to run two cables and then through a system of pulleys because also the cable really only works in a straight line. So a couple pulleys on either side to keep everything straight. And yeah, it's fantastic. And it was, I built it for a coworker of mine, so that way I'm able to keep an eye on it.
There we go.
And I can check in on with him every so often to see how everything's holding together.
Right. As opposed to if it was someone you didn't know, you might not be able to, unless they came back, you know, with shards of metal in their hands and saying, you know what,
right,
put
right.
these back together.
Exactly.
But,
and with this, the guy that owns this bike, we have an understanding that this is all untested and.
Right. And, right. It's like the terms of service on computer stuff. You're just like, well, of course, it's all in beta.
Right.
Yeah. So. Nice.
Yeah,
I was thinking the pushrod thing is almost kind of like roasting a marshmallow on a campfire. Like you know, you can't stick your own hand in there, so you need to use the roasting stick.
Right.
So with a cargo bike, you've got the front wheels way out there, and you can't steer it, so you need something to. That's a terrible metaphor, anyways.
Yeah. Well,
thing that came to mind.
Yeah, when I first started building it, it seemed it would be inconceivable for me to figure that out.
Yeah, well, it's at the same time so simple and so complex, I guess. Like. It's not something that I would go to first just because we're used to bicycles that have, you know, the wheel is right underneath the steering.
Right.
As opposed to remove. So.
Yeah. So the first one I built, I just built it based on looking at pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little nervous to ride it the first time. But what it comes down to is, like you said, it's so simple.
Sure.
That it just, yeah.
Yeah.
It's basic. It's really actually really basic.
I love that it works. I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
So where do you acquire the different parts and like are you buying old bikes or are you picking them up for free off of Craigslist or?
Well, generally what I do is what I prefer is if you wanted to buy a bike from me or have me build a bike, you would bring me the Dalt frame.
Oh right, that's
and,
right. Yeah,
and
I think
then,
it was on your website sometime back, and that was one of the first things I think I saw was yeah, like you bring the bikes, I'll build them together.
Yeah, not being a bike expert, but I have picked this up from people who are into bikes. That there's a lot of measurements and feels and setups that people prefer individually for bikes.
Sure.
I've never explored this because I've always just, you know, you get on a bike and you ride it and
it's fun.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, but people are particular. And when people started contacting me at first, they were telling me about their inseams or their seat height or things like this.
Yeah.
That I don't know why somebody's telling me what their inseam is.
Damn it, Jim. I'm a doctor, not a tailor.
Yeah, right. I'm not sewing your pants. But anyways, so yeah, I find this out through this that people are particular. So then it makes sense. I'm going to have to come up with an adult frame.
Right.
And if I do, then I'm going to charge you for it.
Uh-huh.
So if you bring it, then we just skip that part. And then it's the bike.
That makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, it's the bike that you brought to me. So when the final project... You know, there's a whole list of reasons why this, to me, is the right way to go. But the final product is what you wanted.
Sure.
It fits you. The mechanical issues of the bike, you were aware of ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to find the bike. You know, the list goes on and off of why this works.
Yeah.
Good. But what happens is people have started ordering bikes from me from across the country. And it doesn't make any sense for them to ship me an old bike frame.
Ship them both ways, that
right.
sort of thing. Yeah.
So what I've been doing is I'll look on Craigslist. And we'll talk, you know, we'll just talk individually. What's your budget? What are you looking for? And then I'll try my best to find it.
There we go. Well, that seems like it's a good option because, yeah, I guess maybe some people might be interested in buying a cargo bike and they don't have the frames necessarily. But do you ever get that? Like people call you up and say, hey, I have nothing. Just I want a cargo bike.
Yeah, I've had a few people here locally who do that and they tend to be people who bikes are not, that big of a thing to them either. Mm-hmm. It's something they just ride.
Okay.
So then they're in the same boat as me. They don't know actually what they're looking for. And so I've come up with a few frame models that I look for. And
okay.
Those use our beach cruisers. Schwinn a few years ago came out with a series of bikes called the Jaguar, which was a real cheap Walmart.
Are those like a chopper style sort of thing?
They're not really chopper. They look like maybe they were built by Schwinn in the 50s, but
okay.
They're not.
Right.
I mean, they were built in Taiwan, mass-produced like 10 years ago, and there's a couple different companies that use the same manufacturer because the bikes all are identical.
Gotcha.
They got different stickers on them.
Different head badges, yeah.
Yeah, and since they were sold at big stores like Walmart or Target, They were relatively inexpensive new.
Sure.
And then what ends up happening is used, they're really inexpensive.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're great bikes to weld onto because they're heavy-duty frames.
I was going
to
say, yeah, the cruiser style probably lends itself more to like big tubing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot more room for me to make mistakes, you know.
Yeah, I assume you're working in steel, right? Like, yeah. That's the thing that... Because you can get, I mean, old aluminum frames are definitely not carbon. You're not going to weld onto carbon, right, I guess. But right. Can you work with any other materials, or is it pretty much just steel?
Just steel, because I'm a self-taught welder.
Right.
I work for an airline, and a few years ago, one of our mechanics, during our downtimes or break times, whatever, just for the past time, taught me how to weld.
Really?
Yeah, just hands-on, this is how you do it, whatever. And then I went and bought a cheap welder, practiced at home, and if you look at any of my bikes, you'll see that they're not pretty. And the couple reasons are is because I'm not a lifelong welder.
Sure.
I'm not a professionally trained welder.
It's something you picked up.
And I also am not a guy who has an eye for detail. Like, I'm not detail oriented.
Mm-hmm.
If it holds, then I move on.
Okay.
Whereas a lot of guys are going to weld it, you know, sand it down,
right,
finish it off, and it's going to look beautiful.
That's right.
Not my style.
So we're not talking Oregon Manifest type stuff then?
No, not at all.
They're going for the real pretty sleek as well as functional, I guess. There,
right, but. Yeah. Yeah, I went to the Oregon Manifest the day that they did the trials.
Yeah.
And those bikes are, yeah, I mean, it's like rocket science compared to what I'm doing because
sure.
of the attention to detail.
Right, right. No less authentic, I guess, but it's definitely polished.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I guess it'd be like I'm building a Jeep.
You know? Right. It's more for utility than for flash, I guess.
Right. And they're building, you know, maybe a truck that has, you know, air conditioning and
right.
everything like that. It still
right.
does all the purposes, but it's a little more comfortable.
Yeah. GPS.
Easier to ride.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have the internal hubs, stuff like that.
Sure.
Yeah. So they're fabulous, fabulous bikes, but I'm not even close. Not
well,
even in my dreams am I that close.
Well, I would say that makes you no less valid, sir. I still I'm a big fan of what you're doing. So,
well, yeah, good. I appreciate it. Yeah, and they have use. I mean, and value to people who use them. You know?
Yeah. So what stories have you heard from people who you've built bikes for? What are they using them for these days?
Well, one of my favorites is there's a local bass player here in town, and for a while, he had a standing gig at a bar downtown, and he was having trouble loading his equipment in and out because of parking.
Okay.
And so he would put his bass and his amp and his head unit in his truck, and then he would have to find a place close enough that he could lug his equipment in.
Right.
Which became a problem.
Yeah.
But he didn't have that much equipment. So he came to me, and we built a flatbed cargo bike, and he's able to then ride right up to the front door no matter what parking is like.
That's pretty nice, actually.
Yeah.
That gives you a lot more flexibility and a lot fewer restrictions as far as like where you can park and probably like your lead time as well, like how soon you have to get there. Because if you're driving around searching for a parking space, then that's going to factor another 15, maybe even 30 minutes into your load time.
Right. And then once you get parked, if you're several blocks away, you now have to carry this stuff.
Right. Schlepping gear. I'm a bassist myself, and I used to do a lot more playing than I do now, but I remember just like hauling things around. I loved my amp and I hated my amp just because like you got to carry it everywhere and it's heavy.
Right.
So, and I wasn't cool enough to have like, you know, the casters or something to roll it. I just had to pull it around, I guess, myself. So
right.
Yeah, that is nice. That's a utility. That's a bonus.
Yeah. And so the fact of the matter is it solved a problem for him and he uses it. And so
nice.
That's just great for me.
Yeah.
And I run into him every once in a while and still does it.
Oh, that's cool.
A couple of years now.
Nice.
So, yeah. And I've had several businesses contact me because the cargo bike is a promotional tool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Especially in this town, too. I mean, it's a novelty anywhere, I think. But in Portland, I think people are especially attuned to the idea of, like, you know, like if the business uses and visibly has a cargo bike somewhere, that if you're a bike fan, you're probably going to get more business from the bike fans if you are known as a cargo cyclist.
Yeah, definitely. And also it's just because of the uniqueness of it. Mm-hmm. Anybody who walks by it, anybody who has ever ridden a bike just in passing, even as a child, will look at the cargo bike and stop because you don't get how it works.
Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It looks impossible to ride. And
yeah.
I mean, I get this constantly, people asking me, is it hard to ride?
Mm-hmm.
Because it looks like it.
Yeah.
And so it stops traffic. And I've been, for the last couple of years, I've been setting up on Alberta last Thursday.
Yeah.
And the comments, you know, it's just nonstop. Is it hard to ride? You know, can you steer this? Is it rideable?
It's just so, like the same questions over and over again.
Right. And so then what happens is it just stops people.
Yeah.
So if you're a business and you build one, people are going to stop.
Definitely.
And they're going to have questions about this bike.
Yeah.
And there's been a few businesses in town that have bought bikes from me and they, you know, strictly use them for advertisement.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, fantastic because then with a cargo bike as opposed to a regular bike, the design is almost limited. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a huge space between the front wheel and the handlebars that we can build almost anything.
You can put anything you want in there. I don't know if you remember the Bike Portland News Roundup had some time back a story about somewhere in Holland, I think. There was a cargo bike with it had a container on the front that made runs from like one sperm bank to another, or like from a hospital to a sperm bank. And so I think it was a Bullet cargo bike, and the chest, the refrigerated container that they transported the sperm samples in was like a giant sperm. It was just like this big round, you know, with a long tail behind it. And so, yeah, nice. It was like you were jockeying a sperm around town, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it, something unique that'll catch people's eyes. Definitely noteworthy.
Yeah.
It makes me think of, up in, what is it? The Tacoma, Seattle area where I grew up. There's, this chain of pizza, and beer restaurant type places. And they had like this Ford F-650 truck or something like that with, you know, the company logo on it. And it was like this just enormous truck, you know, like the huge wheel, huge lifted, you know, big engine. And like, I think it had an actual stepladder to get up to the cab and all that because it was so big. And it was one of those things where it's just like, it's a novelty. And, you know, I think they had like a helicopter as well, or like a yacht with their, you know, just ridiculous. But yeah, it's the sort of thing where if you have something that people are not used to seeing, it will garner some attention. So
for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. And then in this town, it gives you a little bit of street cred because of the whole bike community.
We're hip with the kids. We,
yep, right.
we listen to their music.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's cool. Yeah. Any other unique applications of cargo bikes that you've seen?
Well, that I've seen,
or the people that you've sold that you know about.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, Metrofeets. They build just fabulous bikes. I've
right.
seen. I'm a big fan of their stuff, and they have the two bar bikes. And so I was approached by a hotel downtown to try and build a bar bike, and so at first. Not being a businessman, I work for another company and they do all that,
sure,
you know? Yeah. And so this is relatively new to me. It didn't even occur to me that, this place may have contacted Metrofeets also.
Sure.
I just thought, they contacted me and want me to build them a bike. So I came up with a design, and when I presented it to them, they, then emailed me a picture of the Metrofeets bike and asked me about this design.
Hey, can you make this?
Yeah. So then it kind of occurred to me that maybe, you know, this is what they're looking for, why they haven't contacted Metrofeets.
Sure.
Well, come to find out they had.
Oh, okay.
And so then what happened was we were actually bidding against each other.
Oh, nice.
Did not realize that.
A bid war.
Yeah. Yeah. Not my plan.
Sure. So all of a sudden you're just, at least business wise, you're opposed to these folks that you kind of respect and admire and all that.
Right. Right. So I told the hotel that, if they wanted a bike like that, then they need to go with Metrofeets. If
gotcha.
They wanted something else, then we could work with something. Cause I'm not going to build a bike like theirs.
Right. Right.
Strictly because, you know, the main reason is out of respect to their,
right.
But also I don't have that skill.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, I don't like they do.
Tom, that makes you a good man on multiple levels. That's good. So, that's fantastic.
So anyway, so they ended up going with me, and we built a bike that has a 5-gallon beer keg in the front.
Okay.
And a cooling system and a CO2 system hidden underneath the cargo area, and a beer tap out on the rear fender.
Oh, nice.
That's plumbed in. And then a coffee pot out on the rear fender also.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I built a giant oversized fender.
So you get just all of your vices in one place.
Yeah.
Does that have a cigarette dispenser as well?
No, but their plan was to try and for it to be a Portland thing.
Yeah.
With the beer, the coffee.
Right.
And they wanted some artwork on it, like some hand painting on it. So I ended up painting this on the cargo bin. I painted the my sort of representation of the Portland skyline.
Right.
and put Mount Hood in the background, which of course is not in the background of downtown, but whatever.
Yeah, no, that's a small logistical detail.
Right.
And they're not going to use it for navigation.
Yeah, and they have it's the Hotel Monaco downtown.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I
used to work there, actually.
Oh, really?
I was their night porter for a long time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So they have a dog that lives in the lobby.
Oh, that's right. That was, I think that happened after my time.
Yeah, so they wanted me to have a dog bed in it also. So we built an area in it and had a, my wife actually made a custom sized pillow for it.
That's fantastic.
And then they really liked the whole idea that it's made out of recycled parts.
Right, right.
So then they got their art, their dog, their recycled, their beer, their coffee, all in one big
right,
thing.
Right, right. It's just this iconic kind of, what is it, flotilla, I guess?
Yeah, yeah. And so they've ridden it in a few parades, and then they show it off in their lobby. And yeah, it's by far my biggest undertaking. Nice. It was something.
I'm going to have to go look at that now. Actually, a friend of mine that's several years younger than me is, I think, actually doing what I used to do there. And
okay.
So back when I was there, it was the Fifth Avenue Suites. But,
right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I remember that.
But yeah, that was that's pretty great. I'll have to go in, and when I visit him on his night shift someday, I'll also have to check out the cargo bike and visit the dog, I guess. So
yeah.
There's so many things. There's so much changes over the years. It's been at least 6 years, I think, since I've done that overnight. So yeah. No, good times. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking we'll probably wrap up here pretty soon. I'll let you get on your way, and I'll probably have to go to work soon as well. But I was thinking about just like simple living in general. I know you mentioned kind of getting into the bicycling thing. What is there anything else in any other simplifying sorts of practices that maybe you've come to, I guess, after your relocation, your transplant?
Well, yeah. And this is no criticism at all, but in Montana, recycling really doesn't exist.
Sure.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's a tremendous amount of space.
Right, right.
And that's twofold. One, you don't see it, but also just the effort it would put into moving it around to make it efficient.
Sure.
And so when I first moved to Portland, my wife is from here. When we first moved in together, she was shocked at what I would throw away.
Well, yeah, but in Montana, you have like the whole, like you just have one big bin that everything goes into.
Right.
Same
right.
way in Longview, Washington, actually, their trash cans are huge there.
Yeah.
But then you come to Portland and it's like there's like six different bins and it's like, you know, the red things go over here. And
right.
Yeah.
So over the years, I am now shocked at how little trash we have.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, and so yeah, there's things like that. But I don't consider myself a huge environmentalist. I'm going to try and do what I can because of the fact that you don't want to pollute, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it's just no matter what your political beliefs is, it's
sure.
nasty to throw stuff on the ground and pollute things.
But you yourself don't have like a huge bent towards it. It's not like you're not a save the earth sort of hippie.
No,
you have a fantastic head of hair there.
Thank you. Yeah. that is an interesting thing because that tends to be what people look at me as is this hippie that's from Oregon that builds these recycled cargo bikes.
Right.
And, but what I am is I'm sort of this, mechanical guy from, conservative Montana.
Sure.
who's big into, you know, extreme metal.
Right. You're a pragmatist.
Yeah, yeah. So here I am.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So the long hair is, and if you look at my imagery on my bikes and stuff, I tend to have a lot of black and skulls and
right.
this kind of stuff, and it's
right.
It goes to my my interest in the metal end of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. So I it's funny what I get stereotyped as.
Right. But, Tom Labonte, not actually an anarchist.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic.
I work for a huge, large corporation.
Yeah.
Well, burns fossil fuels all day long.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. But the airline industry is a big. You're gonna have a lot of that. But yeah, I think really, and maybe I'll get some flack for saying this in public, but I mean, I feel like maybe what you believe is not necessarily as important as kind of how you implement that into your life. You know, like you're saying, like you're not a huge environmentalist, but like you're doing what you can, and you're recycling stuff, and you know, it's. I think some people are like, you know, you really have to subscribe to, you know, like the theory that the earth is falling apart. And, you know, and I mean, I think there's probably a lot of good reasons to you know, to go in that direction. But at the same time, like even if you don't think that, you know, we're headed to hell in a handbasket, it, you know, there are some good reasons just to, you know, to keep your own part of the earth, nice and green or clean. Yeah, I think pragmatism is a great skill to have. So,
I think you can get, pigeonholed and you can do it to yourself, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And then I think that we cause a lot of trouble that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's cool. Well, thanks for coming in and talking to us. And, we'll look forward to seeing your creations out there on the street.
All right. Fantastic. All that was right. Fun.
All right, folks, and that was our interview with Tom Labonte. Just wanted to thank you again for listening to our show. We wish you the happiest of New Year's. And before I let you go, wanted to let you know what's coming up down the line. We've got on, it'll be available January 9th. Dr. Jeff's coming back to talk a little bit more about transit culture. On the 16th of January, Matt Piccio from the Cast Iron Cyclist and Cycle Wild is going to tell us about his cross-country adventure. January 23rd, Bobby Fatboy Roberts from the Court and Fatboy Show talking about his adventures on public transportation and living in Portland. And then January 30th, Katie Proctor organizes Portland's Critical Mass, and she's going to tell us how that works. Well, we love you very much, and wanted to wish you the happiest of New Year's. Stay safe out there, and we will see you on the morrow. Cheers. The Sprocket Podcast comes to you from the lovely city of Portland, Oregon. You can find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send us your feedback. We really do want to hear from you. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like to hear about. And suggestions for beer are always good as well. The email address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call us and tell us your stories. It's 503-847-9774. I want to give our thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at myspace.com/RyanJLane. Thanks to Hurtbird for letting us use their song, I Like My Bike. You can find them at hurtbirdmusic.com. Lastly, we're on the Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. We're also on Facebook at The Sprocket Podcast. So look forward to seeing and hearing from you.
Auld Lang Syne.
We'll take a cup of kindness now for Auld Lang Syne.